Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Well, welcome everyone. On this January afternoon, January 25th, we're having a special Courthouse Steps oral argument webinar, a panel discussion covering the case FCC versus Prometheus Radio Project. Oral arguments were heard last week, and we're reviewing it today with a distinguished panel. I'm Nick Marr, Assistant Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that expressions of opinion on today's call are those of our experts. I'll just introduce our moderator before he gets the panel started. And we're very pleased to be joined this afternoon by Mr. Lawrence J. Spiewak. He's president of the Phoenix Center for Advanced Legal and Economic Public Policy Studies. He's also an executive committee member of our Telecommunications and Electronic Media Practice Group, the sponsor of this panel today. And so Larry, without further ado, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Nick, and welcome everybody to our panel today, Courthouse Steps, FCC versus Prometheus Radio. We had our arguments were one day before the inauguration last week, and this is an absolutely fascinating case. So before I get started, let me introduce our excellent panelists, who I've had the privilege of knowing for a long, long time. We have first starting with Jane Mago, who is a former general counsel of the FCC. We have Chris Wright, another former general counsel of the FCC. Michael Riley, who was a former commissioner of the FCC. And I was just a mere staffer, so I never got up to the, but yet here you all are. So I guess that says something. So I'm really excited. We have an excellent panel. And the case is Prometheus Radio, which deals with the FCC's efforts to reform its media ownership rules, which, believe it or not, has been going on for about 17 years. And the Supreme Court finally took cert this year. And so this case represents a lot of things to a lot of different people. My own view is I think that this is probably one of the biggest ab law cases that's come up in front of the court in the last couple of years. But again, we'll get to that. And so let's start with just as a good place to start, the beginning and some background so we can get into talking about the case. At bottom, the case involves the proper interpretation of Section 202H of the Telecommunications Act of 1996. So at bottom, the Congress required the FCC shall review its rules, used to be biannually, they changed it to every 4 years, under this regulatory form. And here's the operative, what's at dispute, quote, and shall determine whether any of such rules are necessary in the public interest as the result of competition. Next sentence, the commission shall repeal or modify any regulation it determines to be no longer in the public interest. So that's what the case is about. So I guess as background, although we can't cite it in court, but I always love Mike because, as you like to say, he was there. So while it's not in the commissional record, at least we know that he was in the room. So just before we get into the details of the case, Mike, as you were a staffer way back in the day, what was going through people's heads when they were trying to come up with this set of rules?
Well, thanks, Larry, and thanks for having me. I think you are right to, it does date me as many 25 years ago as it started my professional career to get to this point. But so think back 25 years ago, and it's really 1995, not 1996, because it was signed in February as we come upon the anniversary. But it's really 1995, and it was right after the 94 election where the whole Congress changes over. And Republicans storm in and with a number of seats, the biggest change in decades, and with a different regulatory mindset, a different philosophy for how statutory construction is going to go, and different philosophy on landing spots for different policies. And so you work through 95 and you get to the towards the end. The biggest issue in the 96 Act is telephone. It is, how do you deal with the old Bell monopoly and the breakup of AT&T, the previous AT&T, the pre-existing AT&T, and how do you deal with local and long distance and letting it different providers into different markets? And that is the biggest piece by far. It is the engine driving the train. There are other pieces that go with that. Media ownership is one. There's a couple others that along those lines. And media ownership becomes, you know, it's funny to say, we actually saw, the staffers and the members actually solve the telephone issues and get to the point where, like, everyone's looking around going, okay, we're done, right? No. Media ownership becomes the last sticking point from a good portion of Republican members who really want to see changes and then believe that the text at the time doesn't reflect their views. The changes that are in the statute in the rest of 202 don't reflect where they want to go. And so they craft and they work. And my old boss helped finagle this and work through this language that basically is punting it to the FCC with an aggressive action, like you mentioned, 2 years to resolve these issues. And if you talk to anyone who was in the room elsewise, you know, former Commissioner Furchtgott Roth would say, I can never believe that we're at this point and really the rules have not changed at all. No one who was in the room would have believed that's the case. We thought that most people had thought at the time that the rules would go out in whether it was 2 years or 4 years to be done. It didn't work out that way for lots of different reasons. I'm sure Jane can provide some light to that. But it's important, even though the courts don't really care about legislative history and there's not a lot of legislative text in the conference report, which I helped write. But to be fairness, it's important to put it in context that that was the mindset. And so when people say, oh, it could go either way, you could actually tighten the rules. That was never in the debate. That was never part of the conversations about tightening the rules. It was really just a matter of how soon would the rules go away and what would be the form of that and what would it look like at the end of the day. And to be where we are now is would be incomprehensible to those members who were in the room at the time.
Okay. Oh, thanks, Mike. All right. Well, then that brings us to the actual case procedural posture, which, again, there was three. Chris, I don't know if you want, also, I'll let Jane do this, but Chris, I don't know during your tenure as general counsel whether sort of this whole thing, you had a little envelope, you know, got into this at all. But Jane, why don't you bring us through the rather long and tortured history of this 17-year case?
Well, I think I'm going to try to make it a little shorter than the long and tortured aspect of it. But I also wanted to take us back for 1 minute, listening to you guys and knowing that, you know, I started into this a whole lot earlier, to really put in perspective that the FCC has had structural rules since the 1940s. That's when all of this started. And those rules were challenged, and they went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court each time decided that it was within the scope of the FCC's public interest to be able to have such structural rules in some way, shape, or form. Throughout the earliest part of my career in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, the commission made various changes to those rules, recognizing at first that there was some difference in the media landscape, but they were minor. And they made a few little adjustments, and that was what led to the 96 Act and the importance of what Mike was just talking about, of a real sense of we're not moving fast enough. There's got to be something that we've got to move a lot faster. And so, I'm not going to talk about the first two efforts to implement 202H. It was really the 2002. This is where we start with here. The 2002 review. The commission looked at the rules and said, we should take a comprehensive approach to these rules. We're going to, instead of looking at them piecemeal, we're going to look at them all together, and we're going to devise an empirical test for the media ownership rules to decide when they could apply in a particular market. And that is what started our long, strange journey that we have with the Third Circuit. The case included an action in there that was getting rid of the failed station rule, which had this many elements in it that were very much focused on minority and female ownership. The case went to the Third Circuit, two or three judges. Personal aside for a second, anyone who was at that oral argument the day that the first Prometheus case was argued will never forget it. It was a marathon argument, went for more than 8 hours, as I recall. And seriously, there was a time where the judges looked around the room and said, hey, does anybody have anything else they want to say here? It was stunning. Chris, were you there?
No, I missed that.
Anyway, the Prometheus 1 decision was a split decision, 2-1, which vacated and remanded the case to the FCC. Largely, it was focused on that empirical test and trying to tell the commission that it needed to explain that empirical test. But it also had a focus on the minority and female ownership aspect of it. And one of the most important pieces is that the court decided that it needed to retain jurisdiction over the case. And added the element that they wanted to see what the FCC was going to do. Well, you go to the 2006 quadrennial review, and again, the FCC looked at the rules in a comprehensive way. They tried to relax some of the rules, including the newspaper broadcast ownership rule. And they also included a separate order that was to promote ownership by eligible entities, not specifically minority and female, because the commission concluded that that couldn't pass strict scrutiny, but included that aspect with it. Now, several parties tried to take that case to different courts. In fact, I think the D.C. Circuit won the lottery, as I recall, but then it eventually got transferred up to the Third Circuit because of the remand. So once again, the commission was before the same panel, 2-1 decision again, remanded all of the case to the FCC, focused on minority and female ownership aspect of the eligible entity order, and required an explanation from the commission again as to how the changes in the rules would increase minority ownership. And time passed. So the 2010 and 2014 quadrennial reviews got squooshed in together because sometimes it's just hard to get everything done all at the same time. The final order for those came out in 2016, which relaxed some parts of the newspaper broadcast gross ownership ban, but retained most of the other rules. Now, again, we had a change of election, as Mike was pointing out, and there was a recon petition of that 2016 order. And the 2016 order was the one that went a good deal further, repealed the newspaper cross-ownership rule, modified the local television rule. And the FCC, again, tried to separately ask for comment that whether there was any meaningful evidence about the change, how the impact would be the changes on minority and female ownership. The commission sought to address that separately in the incubator order, which was specifically designed to address those issues. And in fact, those orders went into effect because the Third Circuit decided that it would not stay, that required this despite requests from the from some of the parties. Nonetheless, at the end of the line, the Third Circuit, same panel, 2-1 again, decided that there was not enough evidence to support those conclusions on minority and female ownership. It vacated and remanded both the recon order and the incubator order. The parties asked for the Third Circuit as an en banc to look at it. They didn't. So the parties once again went to the Supreme Court, and this time the court took the case, and here we are. It's been all these years.
All right, thank you. Chris, you have anything on you want to jump in on that? Or
sure. So let me just say to highlight that while these involve all the various media ownership rules, the sticking point for the Third Circuit is long focused on what effect consolidation following rule changes would have on ownership by women and minorities, and has kept asking the FCC this, or, you know, throughout all these arguments. And while I didn't go to the first one, I certainly heard about
it. He missed it.
And in fact, let me acknowledge that I wrote an amicus brief in this case saying that the Third Circuit got it right on behalf of 10 former FCC chairs and commissioners sorry we didn't ask you to join it, Mike, but we thought that.
I think next time I'll weigh in. How about that?
But anyway, the I did call my friend Jake Lewis, who was arguing the case for the umpteenth time, I think, now in front of this same panel, to suggest that he ought to take a toothbrush with him, because given the court's prior rulings in this case and my reading of the commission's order, which was sort of, we don't care what you think about this issue, Third Circuit, that, you know, might get, or sorry, Jake might get thrown into, you know, held in contempt and thrown into the Third Circuit's jail. As it happened, nothing like that happened. I didn't go to this one, but I heard the panel was very civil and polite. But that certainly an aspect of the case that, you know, if, from the court's perspective, the FCC just and multiple FCCs, including the Wheeler administration, have just not been responsive to the question they keep asking. And let me just sort of, well, let me say what our take on the case is on the merits, which is the FCC has consistently said that minority and female ownership of broadcast stations is a proper concern under the public interest standard. And that's what the Pye Commission order said too. I hope we can all agree that who's ever at fault, the evidence, the statistics on this subject have been rudimentary at best. And the FCC has said, we think this is important. We got crummy statistics, but, and I think this is where this commission went wrong, but we're confident that consolidation won't have a serious negative impact on broadcast ownership by women and minorities. And, you know, the Third Circuit, of course, said that the FCC, you know, just flunked basic statistics here. So I think that's right. And in my view, this ought not be an important administrative law decision, although, of course, the Supreme Court can decide to make it one, depending on what it says, but that it's simply a failure of reasoned decision making. And the FCC, you know, on remand, will have to try to do a better job.
Well, let's drill down on it. That's sort of where I want to go next. This case represents, I think, raises a whole bunch of issues, and more importantly, I think it raises different issues to different people. You know, full disclosure, I filed an amicus brief, but I'm in the business of writing law and economic law reviews and academic papers. And I really want, you know, in terms of how much deference do you give to an agency, right? You know, too much deference in agencies run rogue, you know, too strict a review, you are improperly substituting your judgment for the commission. And then maybe did the judge go too far? We'll drill down. Other people, a lot of the briefs were very emotional, and there was sort of a factual thing about you know, again, you know, the effect on women minority, the impact. How does one define the public interest? So, what I want to drill down. I mean, one of the justices had sort of, I think, as I was listening to the oral argument, summed it up that the appellants took a statutory approach on how to interpret 202H. In other words, you know, the context of what the public interest means in that particular clause versus the respondents did what Chris did a little bit and focused on just the arbitrary and capricious review of the agency's decision-making. But as with everything else in a legal case, sometimes it's not that clean. So let me ask you this question. First off, what do we think the legal question is here? I mean, it could be broad, it could be narrow, but Jane, what do you think the court, and then I'll get to more specifics, but just, if you're sitting there, what is the question on review? Because I know the NAB's question on review was different from the Justice Department's question review, which is different from what I wrote was a question review. You know, there's, I'm still trying to dig down to if, you know, why did the court take this case? And what is, like I said, it could be a narrow ruling could be brought. I don't know. But what do you think, Jane? Let me ask you, what is the question on review?
I think that the question on review is the scope of the Third Circuit's decision. I agree with you, Larry, that I think this is an important administrative loss case that deals with what is the scope of what a court can do in reviewing an agency's decision. Here, one of the things that I mentioned when I was talking a little bit was the aspect of this case was how the commission was continuing to take a comprehensive review and looking at all the rules at the same time. I think that what kind of got mushed and lost in the course of this is that not every rule has the same impact on whatever concerns everyone has. And I think this was emphasized sometimes in the argument before the court, like with members focused specifically on the newspaper cross-ownership rule. I don't think anyone has ever felt that taking away the newspaper cross-ownership rule was going to have a significant impact on minority and female ownership, whether that's part of the public interest standard that has to be applied to that case then becomes the real issue. And when you mix it all together, I think you cause great confusion. And I'm hoping that that's what gets sorted out here.
Okay, Chris?
Well, you know, I don't know if I'm digressing or not here, but I noticed at the oral argument, all of the kind of practical arguments supporting the rule changes focused on the newspaper broadcast cross-ownership rule. And I certainly understand them. I have yet to hear some plausible argument for why, you know, letting Sinclair buy all the radio stations in a market is going to be good for anybody. And I think the justices, and certainly Justices Breyer and Kavanaugh, understood that that was almost certainly going to have an adverse effect on women and minority ownership. The last consolidation had had such an effect. And sort of in that situation, either have to say you don't care about ownership by women and minorities, or you have to do a better job of explaining why consolidation there with respect to, say, the local, the other rules other than the newspaper broadcast rule aren't going to have an adverse effect.
All right, well, let's drill down for a second because, again, this case has so many layers. Let's first talk about, and this is why I think this case is important, because it plugs in, you know, we're now talking about the infamous, you know, public interest mandate. And I'm very proud that I put in my amicus brief the old joke that, you know, the public interest means whatever gets you three votes on the eighth floor. Now I guess the 10th floor. But, you know, one of my pet peeves, and this is something I've decided with a junior associate, there's actually a lot of law on the public interest. I think the commission has been derelict over the last 25 years in ignoring that law, but there is law. It is not a concept. And, you know, in this particular case, it is it's not a statutory factor. It is, you consider it along with public interest factor. I mean, it doesn't delineate what it is. And there are instances where the commission has, where Congress has delineated women, minority, the DE program for spectrum auctions is a good example. So one of the things I think the justices were sort of wrestling with was, you know, sort of how much discretion do you give to a non-statutory factor? I mean, in the past, it was heavily weighed, you know, back in the days, you look at the cases back from the 70s, it's coming less so, but where do you sort of draw that line? And then that goes exactly to your point, Chris. Justice Barrett, I've got my notes here, said to focus on the distinction between enhancing and not harming. You see that a lot, by the way, in the FCC's merger analysis, which I think is they're problematic with that without going into that law review. And then, as you said, you know, Justice Breyer, he kept saying this merger approach. What's the theory? So let's start with sort of the bounds of the public interest mandate. You know, we go to you, Jane. You know, where do you think, how do you think the court's going to sort of look at that, you know, the discretion on a non-statutory factor than the evolution? It seemed it was almost like a bit of a Fox television aspect to it where, you know, you had put all this weight over in the past, but now you're departing from that policy. They didn't say so explicitly, but it seemed to be a lot of one could infer. Yeah. So let's tackle that first. I think that's an important question.
Sure. I think there's very much a Fox aspect here that sort of, we spent a fair amount of our amicus brief on behalf of the former commissioners and chairs countering the NAB's argument, which was that the interest in women and minorities is sort of a creation of the Third Circuit in this case, which just couldn't be more wrong. We even had Newt Minow on our brief from the 60s, up through a whole lot of other chairs and commissioners to say that. And of course, Congress in 1993, in giving the FCC auction authority, had specifically required the commission to take into account ownership by, how using auctions was going to affect ownership by women and minorities. And so at the time the 96 Act was passed, it was well settled that an important aspect of the public interest standard was, with respect to broadcast, was ownership by women and minorities, along with the interest in encouraging local, treatment of local issues and other matters. And so when I read Section 204, 202H rather, I'm sorry, the exact language mentions the public interest twice. And the question seems to be, does anything about competition mean that ownership by women and minorities is, no longer important or whatever?
I think you're focusing too much. I'm sorry, Chris.
Go ahead.
I think you're focusing too much. I mean, the commission's definition of public interest, and Larry's gone into it a little bit, has always had a lot of different elements to it. Competition, localism, and diversity have been the ones that the commission's identified over and over again. And in that 202, the 2002 order, the commission went through a fairly extensive discussion of what was the meaning of diversity. Diversity had five different aspects to it, and lots of different things. And the minority and female ownership was an element of that. But if you go back to the ownership rules, and that's one of the reasons I mentioned some of the earlier cases here, the diversity that was the issue there was always a diversity of viewpoints and having more inclusiveness, not anything that was specifically focused on minorities and females, but rather having an open amount of forums to be able to have that discussion. And I think that's where the commission is getting this right at this point, is in recognizing that this isn't the only aspect, the only place where there can be that expression of viewpoints, and that includes all of the other elements of diversity.
Yeah, well, that's certainly true. But at least the NAB's brief here seemed to me to try to draw a line that just doesn't make much sense. I mentioned the auction authority case. Congress did the same thing in the 80s when it introduced lotteries. It instructed that the commission had to consider the effect on minorities and women when it used lotteries to distribute licenses. So NAB would have us believe here that sort of it's very important to examine the effect on minorities and women when you're distributing licenses. But we don't care whether minorities and women keep the licenses if consolidation makes their participation in a particular marketplace, untenable.
I was going to jump in a little bit here and say a couple of things. One, Chris made the point in terms of, the Third Circuit and Jake Lewis going, to get his hand slapped. I think that many members of the commission who did the recon, certainly I, was of the mindset that we're going to look past the Third Circuit, knowing that they have gotten it wrong for quite a while and getting to this exact point we're at. This is going to be something that was going to the Supreme Court. And so I didn't much care about what the Third Circuit's opinion was and was moving past that point. But in terms of the public interest that Larry raises, there were great, you know, in my time working on the committee, there were a great number of members who wanted to define the public interest and put it in statute what it could be, because they were found the commission, you know, in the 90s to abuse what the public interest is. And one thing that to be, you know, I have another point here before I get, you know, get to Larry's bigger point, but you know, we've it's been mentioned women and minorities. After Adirond, that the commission has changed the, you know, its viewpoint. It's not women and minorities, it's small entities. And if you look at this in the auction authority or you look at it elsewhere, it's no longer that. When the Third Circuit is searching for the commission to do its own studies on women and minorities, it has no grounds in my basis to statutory grounds to require such a thing. So to tie those things together and say this is what the commission has always done, or you know, I think that got exposed in the Supreme Court oral arguments, and that's why I think Larry points out, you know, which is the approach, what is the legal issue. I think the NEB's point was his statutory construction. I think Helgi Walker did a really good job of, you know, I didn't think her tone really worked to the members that she was speaking to in her questions, but I think it worked for the other members, and that's what I think was really helpful drilling down to exactly what was at issue was critical for the members that, you know, trying to figure out how do I win the right votes to get to my end goal.
So I keep going back again, having written more law reviews on the definition of public interest than I care to shake a stick at. It's just been my personal pet peeve over my career. I keep going back to the Supreme Court case called NAACP versus Federal Power Commission, where the court basically said, you know, the public interest is not the, you can't solve the world's problems with the public interest. There are constraints. You have to look at the statute. And what's actually, I've made this in my argument brief. If you look at how one defines a public interest, the purpose, going back to, I think it's section one of the act, it's really the emphasis is on deployment of facilities. Ownership was sort of irrelevant, which is why, again, we've sort of talked about it. But I mean, if you want to go back to the statute, but again, how much that public interest, again, from the 20,000 foot level, can the public interest be used to solve the world's problems or not? I think is really one of how the precedent comes out of this case. And the answer is, you know, I don't know. And again, we don't know how the court's going to do it, but I think that that's a really interesting point. I think going to Jane's point, again, if one takes the statutory argument, that's why I read the statute. It's the public interest in the context of that 202, because it says necessary in the public interest as a result of competition. So it should be interesting. Now, whether or not, you know, again, we don't know how the justice is going to do it. All right. So let's then move on to the second, I think, really big question, which Chris alluded to earlier, and that is the sufficiency of evidence. You know, the FCC made a statistical analysis based on what data it had, but the Third Circuit, one of the things that they said was, you know, we're not going to grant let the media reform rules, media deregulation go into effect until you produce a new study that meets with my satisfaction. I mean, I think that's an important legal point. So this is something, and also all three of you, because you've all served at the commission high-ranking levels. I mean, one of the problems with comments is, you know, the way it works is garbage in, garbage out. You know, and I think in this case, Justice Gorsuch made the direct point going, you know, the FCC asked for data and nobody put anything in the record. So what do we do? I mean, that's a really, you know, think about all the big rulemakings and adjudications going forward where, you know, how much, what is the standard of an administrative or the duty of an administrative agency to go out, solicit new data, not to do it? I mean, I think that's a really big argument. And then that also that gets you into the problem or lack thereof of the validity of predictive judgment. So Mike, let's start with you about, you know what it's like. You've got to make a decision based on the record. Well, what it'd be like just as a policymaker sitting there going, oh, this record stinks. And Lord knows we've seen plenty of records stink at the FCC. You know,
well, look at this. There's two things. It's not just it's statutory construction, and it is the record. They're the buying the decisions, certainly from my when I sat in those seats in that seat. But to your point, you know, how do you balance these issues when you have a very empty record? I don't know how many times I begged outside parties on cost benefit analysis or full, you know, except for net neutrality. And I don't, we're not going to go into that today, obviously. The record is paltry in so many different issues. And you could, there's only so many times you can ask people, whatever your views weigh in here, I don't even care what they are, but I need a fuller record to be able to either agree with or disagree with or analyze to be able to make a better sound decision. And you see that in a number of items where it comes back and the staff and the draft will say no comments were filed on these exposed issues. And you have to then make a decision based on, you know, test reconstruction and where you think the best interest lies in where decisions to go. It's not an easy case to make. You beg people to do so. And when they don't deliver, what need to do? And that's why it gets to the point of the court mandating an effect that the commission come forward with its own studies, I think is far beyond what the statute requires and what their authority should have been.
Chris?
So I would point out here that this is a situation where, of course, the broadcasters have the information, and they're certainly the logical ones to come forward with something. And the only sort of the most relevant evidence, I think everybody agreed, was sort of what happened after the consolidation about 20 years ago. And we know that the numbers went down in the short run and recovered in the longer run. And that seems like what's most likely to happen again. If there's further consolidation, the numbers will go down, at least in the short run. Maybe they'll recover. But it's hard for anybody other than the broadcasters to sort of explain why that would happen, or, you know, they have the data. The FCC collects this data on these form, 343s or something. And I looked at that, and boy, that does look like a hard form to make sense of. Anyway, I digress, but I think in this situation, if there was a good reason to think that further consolidation wouldn't reduce the numbers of broadcast stations owned by women and minorities, the people seeking consolidation should have the burden to make that case.
I'm not sure what data you think broadcasters have, Chris, but to the extent that what you're trying to do is I think what you just said highlights again that you're focusing on one aspect. When you try to look at the broad public interest, you have to look at all the elements and what is there. And the broadcaster's argument has consistently been that there needs to be some consolidation in order to have retained economic viability of the broadcast industry in the course against all of the other things that are changing in the marketplace around us. And that includes entries by new entrants. And that's why I think the commission's incubator program in particular was one that made far more sense than trying to retain structural rules until somebody can prove that there's not going to be an impact on minority and female ownership, short-term, long-term. But you have to focus your regulation on the problem at hand. And I think that's where this case has gone awry, is that there's been sort of a generalized angst that by the Third Circuit that has caused a stagnation that is not acceptable.
Go ahead, Mike.
Well, I was just going to say there's two things I think you have to take into account is that, you know, we talk about the data from previous consolidation. Well, this item, you know, the recon basically didn't deal with radio. So a lot of, you know, saying that that should be part of the analysis is in the data from 96 Act and the resulting caps that were put in there is hard to match here. And I'd say Congress spoke to this and said, here's the standard we want you to use. And it's just like they did in the broadcast incentive auction. We recognized, and I helped draft that language, recognized that it was likely to reduce the number of small entities, women and minority, that were broadcast holders of television licenses, and required the commission to move forward notwithstanding. The policy has been articulated. Whether people like it or not is a different story.
Well, let me ask you this. It actually brings me to my second question in this particular topic. I mean, again, going back to the legal issue at hand, you know, we're talking about the validity essentially of predictive judgments. I mean, that comes up a lot. It came up, and very often, you know, sometimes, you know, it's a generalist court. I can say this because I work with economists and people go, you must be an economist. I said, no, I don't do math. And I know that any lawyer, they see math in front of them, they just freak out. And I got it, right? But you do have this issue here of the validity of a predictive judgment. But I think the Judge Sirico did the dissent in the Third Circuit made an interesting point, which bears to this case in terms of, you know, is it okay to deregulate when you do have a backstop? And in this case, the statute is clear. It is an iterative process. You've got to go back and look. And the argument that Judge Sirica made, which I thought was a good one, was if you let the rules, the deregulation go into effect, right? If everybody's complaining about we have no data, and all the data that was in the studies that were in there were not predictive either. They were backwards looking, they were not forward looking. Then you let the rules go into place, then you can have a counterfactual, and then, you know, you can decide whether they're good or not. I mean, you know, what one commission can undo, the next commission can do, or vice versa. What about that argument in this particular case? Because it is an iterative process, this isn't the proverbial, as I like to say in the old school, you know, set it and forget it, you deregulate, you never see it again. You've got to come back under this statute every 4 years. Why is that not a problem? Why is that a problem here? So, Chris, let me ask you that question.
Well, let me start with more generally on predictive judgments, because I'm sure a Federalist Society group, you know, understands the dangers of letting federal agencies make predictive judgments willy-nilly, if you like.
If they rely on our work, go ahead. Other people, no.
Yeah, we all do that. And it's a bipartisan failing. I don't, you know, it's sort of, right, what would we like to do? Let's make a predictive judgment of the world.
But that's part of the function of the problem, exactly.
If we do that, but there's a need for courts to rein that in. Mm-hmm. And again, if what the commission had actually said was, you know, we don't really care about the effect of consolidation on ownership by women and minorities. We think that the effect, you know, the health of the radio industry is going to outweigh that. We'd have a very different case. They might or might not be right about that, but it would be a different case from this one, where they made a predictive judgment that consolidation isn't going to harm ownership by women and minorities. And I don't think that passes a straight face test, and courts ought to rein them in.
All right. Well, Jane, again, going back to the iterative process, this isn't the like net neutrality, which may or may not come. This is by statute. You must come back and look at the rules in the market every 4 years. How would you respond to Chris's argument on that?
Well, I think it's true. The commission does have to come back and look at it every 4 years, and they need to make some sort of changes. If you just stick in the same world over and over again without having and then expect to have more evidence, you're not going to find it. But I think the concept of the predictive judgment here is that the commission has to do the best that it can. And I disagree with Chris's characterization of what happened in this order. I think what the commission said, look, we don't think that this is going to cause a massive problem. We think that based on the evidence that we've got, this is the best we're going to do, and we need to move forward. And that's the iterative process. That's how you do it. And if you have a problem in a few years, then you look at it again.
All right. Well, let me move on here real quick, because we're running short of time. So I have two big things to talk about. My next topic is what I would describe as the primacy of the Third Circuit. We kind of talked about this at the very beginning. Yeah. And I was actually surprised, you know, Jane, even though you sort of gave the procedural history of the case, that many justices were confused, as am I, why this is still sitting here at the Third Circuit for 17 years. In fact, I forgot which justice it was, but they used the phrase, they're concerned with both, quote, both the duration and the scope of the Third Circuit review. And so I think, though, if you sort of pare that down to the ad law question, you know, under State Farm, agencies are supposed to have, be accorded, you know, they got to show their whys and wherefores, but they're also supposed to be accorded great deference. And where the line is, and again, I'm not sure where the line is, and this is going to be interesting whether the court gets into it here, is, you know, did this court improperly substitute its judgment for that of the commission. I mean, that's really sort of one of the issues here. And then what's interesting to me is sort of the precedential value of this whole thing. Because if you look at my brief as I was doing this, I found a law review from Justice Breyer, then Judge Breyer, when he was back on the First Circuit. Mikey, you're being photobombed by your adorable daughter. It's okay. That's perfectly acceptable.
She had to get her mini mouse, okay?
These are important, far more than this case. But what was interesting about Breyer's law review from this was like 85, was that he was talking about the problem of too strict review. And he said, you know, if you're an agency and you know that no matter what you do, you've always got a hostile court, you've got a million things on your plate, the phrase he used was, why bother? And that's kind of, I thought that was, it was really fascinating. So let's talk about that for a minute. Mike, let's talk about, because like you've sat there, just as a former commissioner, you know, one of the things is that, again, you know, it's been one court for 17 years and, you know, commissioners are busy. The commission's got a lot of stuff on the agenda. They've got to do this. You get to that why bother problem. So
no, it's a real issue. I mean, look at no one takes a job as a commissioner and goes, oh, I'd love to jump in the middle of this debate that's not going to ever solve itself. And you're, you know, I worked on this for an awful long time and we're still in the same exact spot as we were. I'm hoping that one way or the other, this, you know, holy grail of the Supreme Court will provide some guidance and not just punt it back without much, you know, direction. Let's clear the decks and tell us what the rules are so we can figure this out. Because I think it gets to the next point of, you know, which you have to explore at some point is what's the practical effects of what we're talking about? You know, a lot of this debate we've moved past it. So I would comment about predictive judgments. I would agree with Chris's point. I was one of the few that said it should, you know, and I proposed that we time limit predictive judgments. I didn't win the debate anytime there, and I probably won't ever will. But I do agree there are limits to how long, you know, and what are the ramifications for predictive judgments. So there's something being said there. But the Third Circuit, in my opinion, improperly, you know, captured this case. And would not let anything go forward without a, you know, an imperceivable study that it was seeking. It was never going to be possible. And then you look at that and say, oh, it wasn't just the Republicans, but it's also, you know, Tom Wheeler had no desire to do the studies and made clear that they were not going to do the studies that the court was seeking. And that one was thrown back to the FCC. So no matter what the administration is, it was getting sent back in the same direction, no matter how liberal or conservative, we're getting the same outcome. And that no one wants to sit there and spend time on this if you're going to get the same outcome. So here I appreciate, you know, this commission took the right course in terms of substance, but also was willing to push it forward. And now finally, you know, I said we have to challenge the Supreme Court. Now let's have at it. Now finally we can get an outcome in the next couple of months and hopefully it will just, you know, provide the guidance that we so needed to move forward. One way or the other.
I think that is going to be the importance of this case going forward, is that there needs to be that kind of a guidance of just what are the parameters of what a court can do. I made a joke earlier about the 2010 and 2014 reviews being squished together. And Mike's point is right. It was, the reason was that nobody wanted to try to deal with what they had seen from the Third Circuit from the 2006 review. How were you going to deal with that? And it made it very difficult for the agency. And it is good that we're hopefully going to be able to have some clarity here.
So this is an interesting issue about sort of courts retaining jurisdiction and when within courts of appeals, they decide to have the same panel review the next agency decision. And of course, the arguments that are made in the transfer motions in this case are the ones that appear in all of sorts of filings here, which is that there's a virtue in efficiency for the court that already became familiar with some massive record and the background of the case. Take a look at what the agency did, and that presumably prevailed. All of the transfer motions have been granted here, and on the other hand, it does raise questions of three judges become, you know, the super FCC for a particular issue. That's a problem. On the other hand, if you're concerned about agencies not, you know, thumbing their noses at the courts, well, maybe you want courts to retain jurisdiction the way they do. I will say that when I was on the Rules Committee of the D.C. Circuit long ago, and we asked the court for a little more transparency about when they decide whether the same panel is going to hear the next case or not, we were told to stop asking that question.
All right. Well, let me ask the final question. We've got a couple of questions here in the chat, some of which I think we're going to cover in this last sort of portion. But, you know, I was listening to the oral arguments, and I think Justice Gorsuch said something and sort of gave the money line of the whole oral argument. And he basically said, we're dealing with media rules from the 1970s that Congress asked the FCC to review 25 years ago with the Telecom Act, yet here we are. I mean, I think everybody knows that the media market business has dramatically changed even over the 25 years since the 96 Act. Justice Thomas went at his point to sort of recognize that. Now, you know, courts are a proverbial black box, and on this note, this has been a lot of fun, but, you know, somebody asked me here on the chat over here is that, you know, if SCOTUS does nothing, again, we don't know whether it's going to be a narrow ruling, whether it's going to be broad ruling. Let's say SCOTUS upholds the Third Circuit. Where do we go from here? I mean, what do we do, you know, going forward? Does the FCC do another quieting review and take another bite at the apple? Does Congress step in or not? I mean, nowadays we're now changing what we think is appropriate under the public interest, including, you know, not necessarily the consumer welfare standard. What do we do? And I think that's sort of the, you know, we don't know what the court's going to do, but the precedential effect of this could be huge. So let me turn it over to you, Mike, first, and then sort of comment on that, and we'll keep going.
Look, and I hope the Supreme Court doesn't affirm the Third Circuit opinion. If it does, I think we're in for more morass, and it's probably a 10-year process that will keep going down this road. No, the next commission, I suspect, doesn't have any desire to address these issues. And if they do, they'll do it very narrowly. And if they lose, they'll be fine with losing because they don't, you know, there's no political benefit in addressing these issues if you're on one side of the equation. Different than my opinion. So the status quo works right now politically for many people. It doesn't work for the marketplace. And I think that's what came through in a couple of the comments. Justice Thomas, you know, early on and then later on, and then Justice Gorsuch, you know, the marketplace is completely different. And so what we're doing is we're hamstringing broadcasters and penalizing them on a standard that makes no sense. But, you know, if that's what the Supreme Court comes up with, then we're stuck. And the next commission is stuck. Hopefully that's not the case.
You know, Mike, I mean, Larry, you're right that the Supreme Court is a black box, but I think that the fact that they've had the opportunity to look at this case a couple times before and chose to look at it this time is at least a predictor that they think that there's something important in this case. And having listened to the oral argument, I think what they think is important is the principle of administrative law and what should really be the standard of review and how one has the relationship between a court and an agency and how that relationship is supposed to go forward. And I'm hoping for language that really helps to clarify that.
So I'll just repeat my point that if the court does reverse, that'll sort of empower agencies to disregard judicial oversight. But let me couple that with I've been meaning to say thank you for Mike for his service to the country in defending the proper interpretation of Section 230, which was really a great thing to do.
Such is life. I don't think that everyone agrees with your opinion there. So thank you. But I say one thing last, you know, I hope we're going to talk to practical impacts because I've had the opportunity to talk to broadcasters over the many years in my service and ask them, if you had the chance today, you own a television station, you own radio station, would you buy a newspaper? Oh my goodness, the answer is heck no. Nobody wants a newspaper. There were a couple in really small markets in the right situations, in the right circumstances. There were going to be very little, the practical implications of all of these are really narrow. A number of, we have evidence of combined stations in the marketplace already. And in those instances, it's been, beneficial, in my opinion, more news, more benefits to consumers and viewers on the television side. And on the audio side, hopefully someday we'll get to the caps to be raised. But I think the practical impact of limiting this is just harmful to the broadcast industry in comparison to everybody else that's fighting for the same audience.
All right. Well, let me ask, we have time for one last question, and I'm looking in the chat here. And I think this is, again, we're at the Supreme, so we're establishing broad precedents. And somebody had asked, is there a bias against deregulation in federal administrative law? And if we look at this case as sort of a question, is Congress did say they have an express preference for deregulation. So again, how does that then affect the precedent? Because there are other sections, the other part of Section 230, for example, the good part that everybody likes to cite, that the internet shall be unfettered by, state and federal regulation. There clearly is, until they change the law, a congressional preference for deregulation in the Communications Act. The agency very often has done that kicking and screaming, and sometimes it hasn't done it at all. And that's a really interesting point. I mean, do you think it's possible that the court might go, here, Congress said, go do this. Why aren't you doing that? Or if they don't, I mean, is that going to help clarify that problem? Because that is certainly a precedent that I could see that would affect a wide range of administrative, of ad law, just agencies across the board. So, Chris?
Well, I don't think there should be. I think deregulation and regulation should be treated the same. An agency's decision should be judged by the same standards, whether it's doing one or the other. And I would just note that, Congress in 96 actually changed some of the media ownership rules. And of course, it could have done more, and it could do more at any time.
Jane?
They did change some of the media ownership rules. In fact, it eliminated the national radio cap, which was a pretty significant event. But I think that you do have to focus on the language of this statute. You can't just ignore the specific direction that's here, and whether the court tells the agency that it's got to look at it that way, I'm not sure. But I think that you do have to give meaning to all of the words in the statute. And that's what I think this is going to turn on in the end.
Well, I'll just, I say that 202H is exactly, the point that the Congress did answer a number of different pieces. And this was the, okay, let's do the rest of it. And we're going to punt it to the commission to do deregulation. It wasn't both sides of the coin. Future commission decided differently, and that they were, they were able to do so harmfully, in my opinion. But I think there is a slight, disagreement or inertia against deregulation. And I fought that in my time on Capitol Hill and at the commission. It's heavier lift to do deregulation. And that's not an insult to the great staff that the commission has or the practitioners in the, but it takes more effort to deregulate than it does to regulate.
All right. Well, listen, as I see Nick's face popping up, that means we're out of time. So I'd like to thank our excellent panelists, Jane Mayo, Chris Wright, Michael Riley. I'm Larry Spirak. Thank you again for a really excellent discussion. Maybe we'll do this again when the court actually issues an opinion, and I'll throw it over to Nick here. So Nick.
Thanks, Larry. And thank you all very much. I'm just popping back in to close down. Thank you to our panelists for calling in, for participating in this great panel, especially to Larry for moderating, organizing this, throwing in some questions beforehand. Of course, to our audience for calling in and your great questions. Thanks for sending those in. As always, be checking your email and our website for announcements about upcoming teleforum calls and virtual panels like this. But until the next one, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.